and thanks for coming to my talk. So the work I will tell you about today has been in progress for a few years now, and it's covered in a number of these papers, which have been many of in collaboration with my graduate student Fang Chen, who is just here giving a string theory talk, Andrew Frey, postdoc, and other graduate student Aaron Vincent, Wei, who is actually Robert Brandenburger's graduate student, and Marco Sorelli at CERN. I'm going to focus on the last two. These are the most recent papers, and hopefully get through those. I just want to mention what my own sort of ambition has been and my obsession for the last few years. I've been interested in trying to explain this 511 keV excess that most recently is observed by the integral experiment, but it's been seen by balloon experiments since the 70s. And it's an excess of 511 keV gamma rays from the galactic center mostly, which clearly they're coming from excess positrons annihilating nearly at rest. Here's the nice spectrum. And there are a number of astrophysical explanations put forward, but I would say none of them are very convincing, and there's certainly no consensus, even in the astrophysics community, that any one is really likely. On the other hand, dark matter seems like it's a good candidate, and if it's dark matter with a small mass splitting, I'll try to convince you that that's especially a good candidate. The fact that it looks so spherically symmetric is one thing that makes you think it could be coming from the dark matter halo. But to actually prove that it's coming from dark matter, it'll be difficult unless that dark matter model is causing some other kind of signals, like direct detection or these low-energy beam dump experiments, which I'll mention at the end. Well, one is the radioactive ejecta from supernovae, radioactive decays. Another is positrons created by low-mass X-ray binaries, and there are a few more exotic ones, but I think these are the ones that have gained the most attention.
So just one point. So the galactic bound is also relatively round across the galactic center. So it's not, of course, if you go far out, there's a disk, but... So
yeah, there's actually a disk component to this, which I'm not showing because it's weaker.
But I mean, still, there is a bulge-like component.
This is the bulge-like component.
But it's also in the stars and other things. So that's...
Okay, yeah, it could be just correlated with the matter as well. Well, so the framework I'll be talking about is hidden sector models of dark matter. So let me motivate that. Hidden sectors seem like a nice logical possibility where you could have some extra sector that's dark under the standard model gauge group and is only connected to the standard model by some weak portal interaction like Higgs couplings or the one I'll focus on, gauge boson kinetic mixing between a hidden sector force and the standard model hypercharge. If such a thing exists, then it seems like a very natural candidate for dark matter. It's already dark. And if it's there, a priori, there's no reason to think that it should be extremely simple. It could be just as complicated as the standard model. Of course, unless data drives us to think that it's complicated, we won't make that assumption right off the bat. But these authors a few years ago suggested that data is driving us in that direction, and that in fact with these simple ingredients and if the new gauge force is broken at the GeV scale, then you can explain a number of cosmic ray anomalies and the Dhamma annual modulation. And so when I heard Nima give this talk a few years ago, I got rather excited about it. But in those 2 years, I've been exploring in detail to what extent can you really explain everything, and you'll see it's not so easy. And again, what are these cosmic ray anomalies? I mentioned already the 511 keV, but there are also these other more famous ones, probably the Pamela positron excess at starting energies above 10 GeV compared to what you expect. And the Fermi telescope sees a a more moderate-looking excess. It's not following the fall-off you expect from conventional diffusive models, between about 100 GeV and a TeV.
Excuse me, so what are actually the black dots here in the
camera plot? Oh, gosh. They might be, I don't remember. They might be two different runs, two different data sets. I think they're both Pamela data, and one is an update. But yeah, because it looks like the red ones might have. I don't know. I think they're both Pamela. So, as I mentioned, they wanted to have dark matter with multiple states, and possibly non-abelian dark matter. And the simplest thing that you can write down, which does everything they one hoped for, is to introduce an SU2 gauge symmetry in the dark sector and triplet dark matter, three states. So there's the Lagrangian, and here is the portal that causes communication with the standard model. It's a mixing term. When this triplet Higgs in the dark sector gets a BEV, then it causes kinetic mixing between one of the components of the new gauge boson and the hypercharge. We'll also need another triplet just to fully split the three dark matter states. And then even after the symmetry breaks, one finds that you can have a Z2 symmetry where all of the 1 and 3 components of all of the triplets, and here everything is in the triplet representation, all of these are charged into the Z2, and the middle component, which is the one that got the BEV here, is uncharged. So how does this explain the high-energy lepton anomaly seen by Fermi and Pamela? Well, one can have annihilation of the ground state, let's assume chi1 is the lowest state, into these dark gauge bosons. Remember that the interactions in this Lagrangian, they're all off diagonal because the generator hidden in here is the epsilon tensor. So, So chi1 and chi1 have to exchange something else, chi2 or chi3, and therefore you have to emit 2 of the dark gauge bosons, not just 1. Then these decay on shell, and they decay into anything that has electric charge because of this kinetic mixing. Everything that's charged becomes millicharged under the new gauge group. So if you assume that the scale of the breaking of that symmetry is less than twice the mass of the proton, then that will guarantee that these gauge bosons only decay into things that are lighter than the proton. This is important because Pamela saw an excess of positrons, but not of antiprotons. And so that could explain why. And then since the Fermi excess went up to about a TeV, that motivates you to assume that this dark matter mass is in the TeV, at the TeV scale. Notice these, I've drawn multiple exchanges of the gauge boson here. That's also important. This gives rise to this Sommerfeld enhancement of the cross section, because if we just had tree level Born scattering here, in order to get the effect observed by Fermi, you would need such a big cross section that the dark matter would have frozen out at too small a relic density. But with this Sommerfeld enhancement, since the dark matter is moving so slowly in the galaxy, it has time to exchange many gauge bosons. And that gives it a bigger cross-section in the galaxy than you would have guessed from the Born approximation. So that can reconcile this tension between the cross-section you need for relic density in the early universe and the one you need today in the galaxy. So that seemed all very nice. Now, in addition, a similar-looking diagram can explain where these excess low-energy positrons are coming from for the 511 keV gamma rays. And that is through chi1 scattering, not through annihilation, but exciting this higher state, chi3. And now I've drawn the spectrum that was wanted here, chi1, chi2, chi3, with a mass splitting of around twice the electron mass or a little bigger. If you can excite these chi-3s, then they're able to decay into the ground state and E plus E minus, which is the only thing, if the mass splitting is that small, it's the only thing available in the phase space. Now, this smaller mass splitting was also proposed by these authors because they wanted to use this, these transitions, endothermic transitions, in direct detector to explain the Dhamma annual modulation. We can get an extra seat out for Raphael. Yeah, I'm assuming the dark Higgses also have a mass of order, or the maybe 10 GeV or so.
We'll check their phenomenology if you don't need any
problems. They're very weakly coupled. They're pretty harmless in the early universe. They can actually, you know, Maxime and Joseph had a nice paper where they showed they can be useful for nucleosynthesis if they decay into charged particles with the right rate. They can help solve the deuterium problem. We tried to get our lithium problem, sorry. We tried to get that to work in this class of models, but we didn't. But I think you guys have some examples of that. So yeah, I think these dark Higgses are pretty innocuous. Now, this might look a little bit funny to say these are TeV scale particles with MeV scale splittings, but that also comes about naturally in these models through radiative corrections. If you just compute the one-loop corrections, well, there's some large piece I'm not putting here because it's the same for all of them. That just renormalizes the mass. But the relevant part is the one that depends on the gauge boson masses. And if you take differences of these self-energy diagrams, you find that the mass splitting is of order of the new gauge coupling times the splitting of the gauge boson masses. Every time I say mu here, think that's the dark gauge boson mass. That's my notation. So if you just plug in, and you can imagine if mu is of order GeV, then its splittings could easily be of order 100 MeV. And the rough value of the gauge coupling needed for the right relic density for TeV scale dark matter is around 0.01. So this is in the right ballpark to give MeV mass splittings. Now, when we started looking at this in detail, one of the first things we found, and which was already anticipated by Pospilov and Ritz, is that you need a very big cross-section, excitation cross-section, to get a big enough rate for what's seen. So large that it just doesn't work if you need the dark matter to scatter all the way through this one MeV mass splitting, because that's requiring the dark matter to be on the tail of the velocity distribution to get enough kinetic energy. And there's just not enough of them to do the job, given the actual cross-section, which we computed. This turns out to be a non-perturbative problem, but you can solve the Schrodinger equation numerically. So we did that, and we found that the excited dark matter idea doesn't work unless you assume that you're starting off at this metastable state, chi-2, and you only have to excite through a small mass gap, say 100 keV, before that excited state decays back down to chi-1, as in the figure. So that, we found, could still work. And remember the Z2 symmetry I mentioned? Well, that's sufficient to explain why the chi-2 state would be stable against decaying to chi-1. That transition's actually forbidden by the Z2 symmetry, whereas chi-3 to chi-1 is allowed. So, well, shortly after we finished this paper, there was new data from the Fermi collaboration, which led to stronger constraints on these models. Yes?
So this is in contrast to Arkady-Helmitz results?
Yeah, well, they didn't really, I mean, they just assumed that the original idea would work. They didn't investigate that in detail. And
what is the particular detail? You say it's just that energy, you don't have energetic enough dark matter particles?
You see, when Finkbeiner and Winer first proposed this mechanism, they basically assumed that you could get a big enough cross section here. Uh-huh. And then what Pospelov and Ritz pointed out was that you have to exceed the bound on partial wave unitarity, or else you have to have many, many partial waves contributing in order to get a big enough cross section. So nobody had ever checked whether that works until we wrote this paper and we actually computed that cross section.
What's the paper by Jonathan Fang? Same question?
They were talking about the freeze out of dark matter in the early universe. And so they weren't talking about this excitation cross section. They were talking about the annihilation cross section.
Okay, but they were also saying some of that mass, which is not enough.
Yeah, they were saying that once you take into account the Sommerfeld enhancement that you get already in the early universe, then there's not a big enough amplification between early and late times.
But they didn't use the right cross section, or as you said, you had to calculate.
What did I say?
You said you calculated.
About a different process.
Yeah, these are different processes.
Soft electrons.
This is the excitation scattering, inelastic
right.
Scattering, chi 2 to chi 3.
This is a harder problem.
Yeah, it's harder because, Yeah, it's harder because this is not a point like, when you have annihilation, that's really a point like, you're right at the origin of the wave function. And here, you're just scattering a bunch of low energy bosons. So this really becomes a non-perturbative problem. Arkani-Hamid et al. Actually outlined in the appendix of their paper very nicely how, well, the fact that these are non-relativistic particles allows you to use the Schrodinger equation. And so that allows you to actually compute this non-perturbative process because you can just throw it on the computer. It was still hard, but that's what we did. So, but even this fix now I'm going to show you is not good enough anymore once we take into account newer data from Fermi. And, well, these aren't the only authors that analyzed the data, but here's an example. And the point is that the high energy leptons you get for explaining the lepton excess, those upscatter with starlight in the galaxy and produce higher energy gamma rays. And this is the main purpose of Fermi, is to look for these gamma rays. Looking for the leptons was just kind of a sidelight. And so here's some example of the spectrum of gamma rays observed by Fermi. And here is an example of the kind of signal you'd get from inverse Compton scattering by the excess electrons produced in the annihilation. And this example is chosen to show where you're starting to saturate the constraint. This prediction is moving up into the observations. And so this additional constraint puts a lot of pressure on the models. And in fact, the pressure is so great that it now makes it impossible to explain both the 511 keV excess and these other anomalies. The reason for that is, in order to get a large enough rate of annihilations at the galactic mm-hmm. center for 511 keV, we needed a rather large central density. The rate goes like the density squared. On the other hand, the constraints you get from gamma rays from Fermi are strongest also in the direction toward the galactic center, where you have the highest concentration of gamma rays or of ambient radiation fields. And to satisfy these constraints, you want a small central density. So there's a tension there that turns out to be irreconcilable. Now, one way people have chosen to parameterize the dark matter halo profile is through this iNASTO form that originally came from dark matter simulations, n-body simulations. And here you have some parameters. This parameter alpha and also the scale radius allow you to tune how cuspy the profile is. And there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't have very strong direct evidence of how cuspy our galactic halo is. But anyway, here's what you get in the plane of the annihilation cross-section versus the dark matter mass. If you're just trying to fit the Pamela positron excess or Fermi and Pamela at the same time, you're in these purple or blue regions. But this inverse Compton constraint, which it depends on what value of alpha I'm choosing. Here, I think alpha is 0.17, which is, yes, it's considered to be a standard value that you get from n-body simulations. You see that the inverse Compton constraint is ruling out this whole Fermi allowed region. But we also needed small values of alpha to get a large enough rate of positron, low-energy positron creation. These lines here are showing you the typical predictions from the model, the triplet dark matter model, for various values of the gauge boson mass. Here's another illustration of the problem. In this plot, this is in the plane of the gauge boson mass and the dark matter mass, and these contours are the contours of the predicted rate of positron production. These are the low-energy positrons in the galactic center over the observed rate. And so this dark contour labeled zero, this is the log, is what you want to match the observations. And all this shaded region is what's ruled out by the inverse Compton constraint. So, well, here's a little dark region that's not ruled out, but notice it's at a low, around 200 GeV dark matter mass. So that could be compatible with explaining the Pamela excess, but not Pamela plus Fermi. And if you want to try and loosen this inverse Compton constraint, you can go to less cuspy, smaller alpha means less cuspy, less concentrated dark matter profiles. And then doing so, you open up the region that's allowed a little bit, but you also make the rate of positron production go down. Here I've compensated for that by making the mass gap that I have to excite through smaller. So you can play that game, and that's why these contours have shifted around here. Well, in addition to both of these, changing both of these, shift these contours around. So I've still got plenty of places where I can satisfy the 511 keV observation, but still only this region around 200 MeV dark matter mass that's compatible with the inverse Compton constraint. And if you try to go to even larger values of alpha, then you start getting down to ridiculously small values of delta M to get a reasonable rate of 511 keV. And so it's not working. Well, my only understanding, if it's not just numerical noise, which part of it might be numerical noise, but the other part is that, you know, in this Sommerfeld effect, you have these resonances. And so I think a similar thing could be happening in the excitation cross-section. You get a resonant structure as a function of the dark matter mass, but I'm not sure. It was numerically a very difficult problem to compute these excitation cross-sections. Well, one of the new things I want to tell you about today in the recent paper with Vincent and Xu is that now we're getting even stronger inverse Compton constraints than the ones that I used to derive the previous results. And so there are a few reasons why we're getting different results from other authors. We're using this Galprop program, which numerically solves the diffusion equation to track the electrons and positrons in the galaxy. Some authors used a semi-analytic approach, which It's only semi-analytic because you get solutions in terms of Bessel functions, but then you need to numerically add up zillions of Bessel functions. And for reasons which haven't been, I think, elucidated yet, these two approaches don't seem to give the same results. This is something we should try to figure out, but to me, Galprop is just a black box for the moment. Another reason is that some previous authors use data from regions of the sky which are not the most constraining. If you divide the sky, the galaxy, into little boxes and try to figure out which box gives you the strongest constraint on inverse Compton scattering, well, we find a region of galactic latitude and longitude, which is, it's some quadrant, a little bit offset from the galactic center. Some other authors have used averaged over much larger regions. And so those are a couple of the reasons I think we're getting stronger constraints. This last one I don't think is important. It's just the way we're showing things. But here's... Yeah. You want to stay a little bit away from the galactic center. It turns out that there's just so much stuff coming directly from the galactic center that it doesn't give you the strongest bound. So here's some examples of predictions versus data. Once again, the dots are the Fermi data. And, well, there are a lot of curves here, but just focus on the black one here. This is due to the inverse Compton scattering coming from the excess electrons produced in the main halo. And so you see, and this is for the standard dark matter profile, and you see that this is ruled out by many sigma. Now, some of the previous work that I mentioned was finding that if you softened the cuspiness by making alpha a bit bigger, say alpha 0.23, then you could still satisfy the constraints. But here we're finding that even for alpha 0.25, that there are some data which are a few sigma below the predicted level. So this is making it more difficult to... Oh, and I'm sorry, here's one more. One of the least cuspy profiles that have been considered is the isothermal ansatz. And in previous work, this was considered to be well within the constraints. And here you see, well, at 3 sigma, I guess it's still okay, but at 2 sigma, it's starting to be ruled out. So even the softest profile is running into trouble with our analysis.
So can I
ask, yeah.
So you don't show that theoretical uncertainty. I mean, your model, I assume, has some predictions, but the background, there would be some uncertainty.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, that's another thing that we do that many authors didn't, was including the gamma rays from the electrons in the background. That's this red curve. But you see, it's actually providing a rather small contribution to the total. That's on the log scale.
Where do you get that from other regions of the sky, or?
Well, it's the background that's in Galprop, which is, you know, we know that there should be a certain level of electrons and positrons in the galaxy because we know what the flux of cosmic ray protons impinging on the galaxy is, and so that's used to solve for the background E plus E minus.
I was just imagining that would be something like
that. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that other authors didn't even put it in at all, and so at least we're putting it in, and when we put it in, and we find that it's quite subdominant to the contribution from. You know, this is 10 to the minus 6, this is a few times 10 to the minus 5, so just judging from that, I don't think that's a serious... Yeah, and so it's only going to make the constraint worse if we're actually underestimating it.
How do you evaluate the uncertainty in your black line prediction? how do you know they came from Skype?
Oh, I have no idea. And I don't think anybody else who plays this game knows either. And I think at the moment, it's only the differences between different methods, which is giving you an idea of what kind of uncertainties are. I think the uncertainties are actually rather large.
I'm just trying to figure out what two sigma means.
Oh, okay. Two sigma only means experimental.
Okay.
So, yeah, I agree that maybe one day people will understand how to really compute the diffusion in the galaxy with much more confidence. And but to me, it's a black box. I'm just using what's available. Yes?
Another question regarding the experimental uncertainty. I mean, you mentioned this very, not just off-center, which makes sense, but very asymmetric region of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably chosen in posteriority to get the strongest constraints.
Yes.
Right? So you might worry that two sigma, where you've sculpted your region to be, I mean, I don't know, do you know whether that's, are there no reasons why there's lower background in that region? Or is it just, is it possible that you just focused on the region with a downward fluctuation?
Well, we did choose the region deliberately that was the most constraining. Maybe there's a fluctuation there. Maybe there's some unsubtracted point source there. I don't know. That's another uncertainty. I think, you know, one reason for us to take this approach is that there are a lot of other papers out there which try to give dark matter more of a break and to make the most optimistic assumptions. Here we're making somewhat more conservative assumptions, and I think it gives you a feeling for how different the predictions can be. But in any case, having found this additional hurdle for the models to get over, we're now also suggesting a loophole that might make the scenario work, and that is using substructure. And as you may know, the dark matter halo is not just the main halo, but there's lots of subhalos which have been seen in simulations like Via Lactea. They catalog 20,000, and then there's a lot which are unresolved that they don't even catalog. But here's a scatter plot in terms of their size and their central density. And we've chosen a few subhalos which they're not typical. They're rather atypical in having rather large central density. But what we find is that if one of these subhalos happened to be close enough to the Earth, then they could be providing the main lepton signal seen by Fermi and allow us to overcome these gamma ray constraints.
So the Via Lactea, that's some large in-body simulation.
Yeah.
Is there any experimental evidence for subhalos?
Well, we know that there are lots of satellites of the Milky Way. We can see the big ones. But as far as these smaller ones, I think there's no direct evidence yet.
How do these compare in size to the dwarf?
Well, I mean, there's a whole spectrum. I mean, it's a continuous, it's like a fractal distribution.
Right. I mean, what kind of subhalo mass are we talking about from these points?
Oh, I don't know. You'd have to integrate the iNASTO profile with these parameters, and I don't know what the total mass is.
So my guess would be that like the biggest like 100 of these, or the biggest 50 of these, would be comparable to the Earth Rock Galaxy.
I think that's about right. And here's where the main halo sits, by the way. It's got much lower density, but it's also much bigger. And so here is showing you, if we adjust the properties of the subhalo, which happens, so here's distance of the subhalo to us. And if we adjust the boost factor the Sommerfeld enhancement factor in each subhalo appropriately, then we can get the right electron excess electron observation. That's what this flat line is showing us. Unless, if the subhalo is too far away, say more than 3 kiloparsecs, because of electron diffusion, those E plus, E minus will never reach us, no matter how big the boost factor is. So that's what this black curve is showing you. And then the colored curves are showing you how big is their contribution to this inverse Compton gamma ray signal. And as long as they are farther away than wherever it crosses zero here, that's good. It's satisfying the constraint. So you can see there's a minimum distance the subhalo could be, but it could be up to, say, 3 kiloparsecs away. Yes? Well, I haven't checked it, but I think that, this comes under my caveats. Catch. In order to make this work, we needed for that subhalo to accidentally line up with the galactic center.
it's masked.
Yeah. And the reason we needed to do that is that if it wasn't, then you would probably see the inverse these inverse Compton gamma rays much more easily. So we've assumed that there was this accident in order to hide those inverse Compton gamma rays more easily. Now, it may not be necessary for it to line up exactly. We didn't test all possibilities. This is an existence proof. And the other catch is, I already mentioned, we need specific values of the boost factors in the subhalos to get the electron signal to work out, but I'll show you that we can make that work. So part of the challenge is that the constraint on the main halo boost factor coming from inverse Compton is so strong that you can't get this to work without another knob to tune. This is shown in this figure of the Sommerfeld boost factor, the log, as a function of the gauge boson mass. Here's this resonant enhancement effect that I was talking about in the shape of that curve, the predicted curve. These dotted curves are the limits coming from inverse Compton scattering. So those boost factors ought to be smaller than the dotted curves, but they're never smaller if you assume that the dark matter had a interaction strength leading to the correct relic density, which is what we've done here. So what can you do? Well, there's one thing. There's one very simple way out of this dilemma. Naively, you would have thought, okay, if I make the gauge coupling smaller, then the effective boost factor will go down because the interaction is weaker. So that's one thing you can do, but then the dark matter density, it'll freeze out at too high a density. We'll be stuck with too much dark matter. The other way you could go is to make the gauge coupling much bigger than the value you need for thermal freeze out. If you do that, yes, you're increasing the cross section by some factor F, but you're reducing the density by the same factor F, the relic density. And the thing that counts for annihilations is the product, sigma rho squared. So that is going down by 1 over F. So ironically, by increasing the strength of the coupling, we can weaken the effective boost factor and satisfy that constraint. Of course, that also brings down the boost factors in the subhalos, which are contributing the electron signal that we want. And this column, here are our candidate subhalos. This is showing you that we need those boost factors to be quite big, at least in some cases. This is the log of the boost factor. So this is saying you need a boost factor of 10,000. That might sound like a lot, but remember the Sommerfeld effect is strongest at low velocities, and the velocities in these subhalos is much smaller than the hundreds of kilometers per second in the main halo. So that helps you. And now here's a picture showing you how in the specific particle physics model, actually we're just looking at a U1 dark matter model for this exercise, how we could satisfy all the constraints. These pictures, once again, are these jagged curves are showing you the predicted Sommerfeld boost factor, now including the 1 over F. Here I'm taking F to be 500. So the dark matter that's causing all of this is only 1/500th of the total dark matter. And there's something else out there making up the rest, which I don't care about right now. And so these jagged curves are the predictions for the various subhalos, and the black one down here is for the main halo. These dotted lines are the 1 and 2 sigma limits for inverse Compton scattering of the main halo. So that means this black curve is supposed to be underneath, falling below the dotted curves. Whereas the colored dotted curves are the values of the boost factor you want to explain the observed leptons. So we want those to intersect with the corresponding predicted solid curve. And so what you see is, yes, there are places in here for the dark gauge boson mass less than 500 MeV, where you get intersections with the subhalos and you obey the constraints. And, well, even in here, there's some places where maybe this is okay and this is still below 3 sigma. No, actually, by cranking up that F, we are reducing. See, the CMB constraints also go like sigma rho squared. And so they're also being weakened by the same factor F. So in fact, yeah, we're overcoming the CMB constraints at the same time. So this is the picture, assuming it was a cusp Einasto profile. With an isothermal profile, we don't need to reduce the dark matter density so much. Say a factor of 50 is enough. And then you can find examples where some of the subhalos are intersecting and the main halo is giving a small enough inverse Compton. Okay, so that is a loophole for getting this annihilating dark matter picture to overcome the constraints. And that was supposed to be the first half of my talk, but so I won't be able to go through all the details of this second half. Yes?
So these subhalos that you found, where were they in this galactic? Where they're supposed to be?
Where physically, what radii?
Yeah.
I'll have to ask Aaron that.
Do you need them to be between us and the center of the...
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. And I don't know. I don't think there's a correlation between those properties and the radial position.
Well, there is some that, I mean, subhalos are more easily destroyed the closer they are to the center of the galaxy.
Yeah.
Because there's more highly.
Yeah, that's true.
So at least the big ones might have a hard time surviving in the inner regions. The smaller ones might be okay.
Yeah. I'll have to find out.
You have them in the,
I can find out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, in my last 10 minutes, I will just try to briefly tell you about something completely different, but it's not quite completely different because it's still talking about hidden sector dark matter. But now I want to think about light dark matter. And this is relevant. There have been many papers proposing light dark matter, say 5 to 10 GeV, to explain the Dama annual modulation and some more recent hint of anomaly from the Cogent collaboration where at low energy electron, in the low energy electron spectrum, they see an excess of events which they can fit to a 7 or a 10 GeV dark matter interacting in the detector. Here's showing their allowed region in the cross section and mass plane, see, around 10 GeV, and comparing to what you need to fit the Dama observations. Depending on unknown things about Dama detector response. So there's a fair bit of uncertainty about how to fit to Dama, which is being discussed a lot in the literature these days. And so the reason that I want to come to this is In what I was saying before, I was kind of giving up on explaining the 511 keV gamma rays, which are so near to my heart, and I want to find another way to get them back into the picture, and also hopefully predict something in addition that might convince us that it's not just 511 keV, but there's something else. And there was a proposal by these authors that if you had exothermic transitions between the dark matter with two states and a small 5 keV mass splitting and a small dark matter mass, then you could explain, here's mass splitting versus dark matter mass, in these regions you could explain the Dhamma annual modulation. And in fact, you need to be in these smaller corners to not violate the unmodulated Dhamma rate. So our idea was, this is showing that those same authors, here's their Dhamma prediction in cross-section versus mass plane, that they can also explain cogent events. So our idea was to try and piggyback on what they were doing. They were just interested in two states with a small mass splitting. Well, I showed you two states with a small mass splitting, except there was a third lower state with a bigger mass splitting. And so we'd like to see if we can do that and get everything now. And there's two scenarios. There's this exothermic one that I just mentioned, where you could start off in the top state and have a transition to the middle state. Say the top state is stable, the middle state is unstable, and so it quickly decays into the ground state and E plus E minus. Or you could have our original idea of starting with the middle state and needing a small excitation before you decay back down. And we argue that both of these possibilities can work, and they can both be compatible with these direct detections. The only extra thing we need in the model is now you find that with such light dark matter, this mass splitting is natural. The gauge coupling goes down to get the right relic density, and so the mass splitting also goes down. This one now is too big to get from just a radiative correction, so we need to throw in one other, a Yukawa coupling with some symmetric tensor field, which it can get a VEV at the same scale as the other fields, but it just needs a small Yukawa coupling. And then that can be the source of the large mass splitting. And that can be made to work. So what we find is that now we're able to explain all of these observations. Here again are my rate contours for the positron production in the galactic center. And the black contour is the one where we want to be to match the observations as a function of the mass splitting and the dark matter mass. And so you see there are some regions here where we overlap with what one would want to explain Dhamma. And, there's dependence on the gauge boson mass. That's what's varying between these pictures. Basically, that comes about because this state that we're starting out with, which is metastable, we have to worry about its relic density. Chi-3, suppose that's the metastable state. In the early universe, it could downscatter by the same process that we want in the galaxy. It could have downscattered in the early universe and depleted the original relic density. So we solved the Boltzmann equation to find out how much that happens, and that's all included in this. And, of course, the lighter this gauge boson is, the more effective that process is in the early universe. And so there is some preference toward larger gauge boson masses coming from having a big enough relic density. But on the other hand, there's a preference for smaller gauge boson masses coming from getting the right rate in the galactic center. Yeah, sorry, I said it wrong. This is the one that gives you downscattering in the early universe. So that wants a heavy B2, but you want a light B1 to get a large rate in the galaxy. So there's this competition. That's why you get this dependence on the gauge boson masses.
Yeah, we have to take into account also co-annihilations, co-scatterings.
so to speak, because...
Off of what?
They are like chi 3, chi 1, going to chi 2, chi 3, and so on, so that, I mean, just the elastic scattering between the...
Not at Born, not at the Born level, because... Chi 1, Chi 2 goes to B3, and B3 only talks to Chi 1, Chi 2. So we don't have that.
So you're not interchanging number densities here?
No. You know, that's one nice thing about this triplet model. Everything's very simple. Now, one sort of fly in the ointment, to get all of this to work, I needed to assume a very cuspy dark matter profile where alpha, instead of being the standard 0.17, was way down here at 0.065, and the scale radius was at a very much smaller value than what's considered to be standard. Why is that not ridiculous? Well, these standard values have come from dark matter simulations that only include dark matter, not baryons. And authors who have re-simulated those profiles, including the effects of baryons, which undergo compression and they drag the dark matter with it, are able to produce halos which are much cuspier. And so here's a sample of six halos they get from their simulation that started out with alpha 0.17 but due to the baryons became much more contracted. And so we've used the extreme case that they found to get those results. And you see if you go to even a moderately less extreme case, then the rate starts to go down toward the tail of what you need for Dhamma. On the other hand, that was with the exothermic model. The endothermic model actually works better. And we treat the endothermic model as though it were effectively elastic scattering to match. Several papers have pointed this out, but if you just have light dark matter undergoing elastic scattering, then you can find regions of parameter space that are consistent with both Dhamma and cogent. And so, since we're undergoing such a small inelastic scattering, we can convert that into an effective elastic cross-section to do the analysis for that model. And then we find this nice region of overlap for small mass splittings, which overlaps with the preferred region in this endothermic. So endothermic, that's a model where you had to upscatter first before you decayed. But there's a third scenario, which may be the nicest of all. And that is, maybe you don't need to have scattering at all. Maybe that state that we were trying to scatter into was so long-lived that it's already there in the galaxy, and then all you need to do is decay. That's much nicer because that cares less about how cuspy the profile is. You don't need scatterings. They're already there, so you just need them to decay. And that just requires this kinetic mixing parameter to be rather small, 10 to the minus 11. So, yes, that doesn't sound very nice, but remember it is coming from a higher dimension operator that's suppressed by some heavy scale. So perhaps it's still reasonable. And the interesting thing about this scenario, besides the fact that it just works much easier, is that now, if you look at the angular distribution of the positrons that you create, so we're able to match these data points, or what Integral observes, we're able to match that angular distribution with a somewhat less cuspy profile. And the interpretation is that maybe this integral signal is actually giving us a picture of the dark matter halo profile in the galactic center where we have almost no other information constraining it. So if that were true, that would be quite interesting. This delta function here, this is what you get if we're in the scattering scenario because rho squared is so concentrated. And it means that if that's the case, then the signal that we see from integral isn't just a reflection of where the positrons are created, but they had to propagate before they annihilate, which is also quite reasonable. There's great astrophysical uncertainty about how far positrons propagate before they annihilate. So I think both of those scenarios are viable from the astrophysics point of view. Well, I've just got a few minutes, but I only have a couple more slides. So if any of this was true, obviously you'd like to have some other handle on it experimentally. And so one nice one is one that's been widely discussed by our new members here, Natalia and and Philip, which is having a beam dump experiment where electron beam hits target, makes a few of these dark gauge bosons, which then decay into E plus, E minus, and are detected. So these would be excess E plus, E minus that you wouldn't get normally. Another one is coming from this process where chi 3, instead of decaying directly into chi 1, E plus, E minus, there's this magnetic moment interaction at one loop that could allow it to decay into a single photon. So maybe one could see this MeV-ish gamma ray. So on the first point, there have been a lot of analyses lately about what's the uncharted territory in the plane of the gauge boson mass and this kinetic mixing parameter epsilon. And you see all this white region is still uncharted territory, just ripe for being discovered. And it's also compatible with the predictions of some of these models. The N and the X stand for the endothermic and exothermic versions of the model I was just talking about. And Natalia and Philip are involved in the APEX experiment, which has this. So these outlines, these are experiments that were possible experiments, which were mentioned in this paper that Natalia's on. And this experimental reach is of an actual experiment that is ready to go, APEX at JLab. And so you see that at least one version of our model is within their reach. What about this gamma ray signal? Well, it turns out that the first possibility I mentioned is too slow to see. We won't be able to see an MeV gamma ray with integral. On the other hand, in that exothermic model, there's also the same possibility with the smaller mass splitting. And this actually is probably already ruled out by Chandra observations. Here is what Chandra sees, their spectrum, looking at the galactic center in the 5 keV, around the 5 keV mass range. They don't see any bumps there. So this could rule out that model already. Sorry. Well, to conclude, I've tried to show you that this hidden sector scenario with heavy dark matter can still work, although it requires some tuning. And I know some people in the audience who would say, "Ah, it's just pulsars." I won't argue with them. On the other hand, if we go to light hidden sector dark matter, then we can explain these other anomalies. In fact, these are not incompatible, because remember, for the first one, I needed this to only be some fraction of the total dark matter. So I could have both of these going on if I wanted to. Well, of course, there are other models out there that try to explain Dama and Cogent. But just focusing on the 511 keV part, I think if that is coming from dark matter, then this multi-component idea where you have decays is probably the best particle physics explanation that's been put forward. And also, unlike the Pamela and Fermi anomalies, where we have a very good astrophysical candidate, pulsars, that can explain the data, I think the astrophysical mechanisms for the 511 keV one don't look as convincing. So I'm still hoping for dark matter explanation there. And hopefully we will get some hint of that from these fixed target experiments that are coming online soon, and even some that are running now. One thing I would really love is if there was a higher resolution instrument than integral that was looking at the 511 keV signal, because, yeah, it looks roughly spherically symmetric or axisymmetric, but the resolution is something like 3 degrees or 2 degrees in the sky. And so if there's structure in there at smaller scales, we can't see it. So I would I would love to have some better observations. Well, sorry for going a bit over, and thanks for listening.
So I have two questions about the observations. One was that the electron positron excess that you showed from Fermi didn't look that high. And
no, it doesn't look that high, but the fact that it rises and makes a bump rather than, I mean, if it was just falling off more slowly, then maybe you would think less of it. But the fact that it has this bump-like structure, and probably another reason that people were more impressed by it was the fact that before Fermi, Attic was seeing this bump, which looked a lot more impressive. So people were already thinking about a bump being there when Fermi came out. I guess if it was only Fermi, if it hadn't also been Pamela before that and Attic before that, perhaps it wouldn't have attracted as much attention.
So the thing is, like the other study, you don't have theoretical uncertainty here in that curve. So I might.
Yeah, that's right.
There would be some uncertainty there.
I'm sure there's uncertainty there. I think it's harder to get a bump than to get a monotonically. Nobody who designs these models has any reason to expect a bump there, I guess, is the problem.
Okay, so my other question was this so-called WMAP haze that people tend to talk about. You didn't mention that. Why is
that? I didn't mention it because I don't find it, well, first of all, I think it's controversial. I know people who really don't believe it, and, you know, it seems like it's a very delicate procedure, doing the subtractions correctly and knowing that stuff that's left over is really signal and not something that you should also have subtracted. I'm no expert on it, but it just doesn't look as robust to me.
So in the models where you were relying on these microhalos that are almost aligned with the galactic center, are there constraints from lensing surveys where you know something about, you know, the possible total mass of objects, say, in between us and the galactic center?
Yeah, well, Gaia is going to make such constraints. And that's one of the things we looked at in seeing if we could find predictions of the model. Well, one prediction we did have was just, you know, predicting what spectrum Fermi should see of gamma rays once they've really removed all the point sources. But you know, the other one would be exactly what you were saying. And it looks like it'll be very difficult to extract that because this subhalo is making such a small blip. It's like, I think, 0.01% of the ambient density on the background. So we haven't looked in detail, but I think it'll be difficult.
About solving the diffusion equation with this black box program, whose name I can't remember.
Galprop,
yeah. You said there were uncertainties. Is the uncertainty in whether the program is doing what it ought to, or is the uncertainty in setting up the diffusion equation? Why did you say there was a lot of uncertainty?
Well, there are a lot of knobs to tune in this program, and so some of them you tune, like one of the big uncertainties is the magnetic field of the galaxy. So people have educated guesses about that, but it's pretty uncertain. And there are things like, what's the thickness of the diffusion zone? So people make assumptions about that. And there are, and you have to fit all of the, like, boron to carbon and other such observables. So you have a few constraints on these various parameters, the many parameters which I don't know. You see, Aaron Vincent, my student, is the one who actually did all this, and he can answer this question much better than me. I would say.
So basically, it's uncertainty about certain astrophysical parameters that go into the.
Yeah, there are a lot of phenomenological parameters.
It's not uncertainty in the program functioning the way.
Yeah, well, one thing, I mean, there is a 3D version of the code which really solves it in 3D, but what it usually The fastest way of running it is in this 2D mode where you assume axisymmetry and then you reduce it to an RZ problem. So that's one approximation. Yeah, I'm sure there are plenty of improvements that could be made, but it's one of these monster things which would be a major effort to try and redo.
One thing, I guess, when I last looked into this, that was a few years ago, but one thing they asked for a constant diffusion coefficient across the galaxy, and I don't think there is any reason that it would be constant across the galaxy. Different regions of galaxy are different.
Yeah, and they also care about what is the distribution of radiation, so the different radiation fields in the galaxy. That's built in. That's one of the good things about Galprop. It has built in actual measurements of that.
Well, that's the thing. That's something you can actually measure because you can see stars, but you cannot see the diffusion in different regions of the galaxy. It's only a local measurement.
Yeah.
So another question about, can you, if you go back a couple of slides, you showed this experiment potentials.
Oh, you mean at the end?
At the end, yeah, with your exothermic and endothermic predictions. Oh, yeah, there. I'm not sure whether this refers to the second part or the first part of your...
It's the second part.
So then you had a third scenario.
Oh, yeah, the decaying...
What does that tell you? Would you like better somehow than the first two?
Yeah. So actually, the decaying one can actually be compatible with either of these because... So the epsilon I'm plotting here is the one that's responsible for the... there are three gauge bosons, each has its own kinetic mixing parameter. And the biggest one is the one that's responsible for the direct detection, so scattering off a nucleus. And the difference between whether it's a decaying or a scattering one only depends on one of the other epsilons, which controls if that particle is long-lived or not. So actually, these could both be compatible with that decaying scenario as well. That's just another parameter we have to tune. I think you...
Yeah, so you mentioned these Chandra X-ray observations.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that exactly claimed by Kusenko and collaborators that they see an unexplained X-ray line, which they interpreted in terms of a stellar
neutrino? Oh, yeah. Is that like KEV-ish? Or 13... what was it?
Yeah, I don't remember.
17,
aspect,
well, I think it was a 17 KEV. Yeah. And, well, those... We need, to get all of these things to work, we needed like 4 keV or so. We couldn't push it up to 17 keV. But yeah, maybe if you just want to explain this anomaly, you could take this class of models and adapt it for that. I hadn't thought about that.
Okay, let's wrap up. I've been here for a long time. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.